It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a scientist in Canada wants to overhaul science education to make it more hands-on and engaging for kids.
First, the Trump administration sent its budget for 2018 to Congress. The new budget calls for cuts into programs for the poor, an increase in military spending and border security, and includes big tax cuts. Here's a clip from President Trump's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, from a press conference earlier today talking about the budget. The new budget is called A New Foundation for American Greatness.
Well, it's called the New Foundation for American Greatness, but I wanted to call it the taxpayer first budget. It struck me that that was what was really new, or one of the things that was new about this budget, that we looked at this budget through the eyes of the people who were actually paying the bills.
Jasmine Ferrier joins us now. She's a political science professor at the University of Louisville. Jasmine, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, before we get into the details of this budget package, tell us, what is the president's budget?
The president's budget is the beginning of an annual cycle. And since 1921, presidents have been responsible for gathering estimates, analyzing them as a whole, and presenting them to the Congress. Only since 1974 has Congress had a mechanism to respond. So we can get into those details in a bit. So the president's proposal, again, is just a proposal. It's also a symbolic and electoral document in that it tries to present how the president is translating his campaign promises, his perception of the election, into action.
And how does the budget process work now that this document has been sent to Congress?
It's a little behind schedule, which is typical of a first year. You may recall that the president sent a so-called skinny budget in March to Congress, which was a heads up about some of these priorities. What happens next is that the congressional budget committees, there's one in the House and one in the Senate, go to work to provide, ideally, a comprehensive response, and that's called the Congressional Budget Resolution. That resolution does not go back to the president for signature. It's an internal document that is ideally meant to shape all the decisions to follow on taxes, entitlements, and appropriations. But the Congressional Budget Resolution must be agreed to by both the House and the Senate. Even though those bodies are both under Republican control right now, there are a lot of philosophical and electoral differences between them.
And on face value, these numbers are pretty scary for some entities and for many people. What do you think people misunderstand about this budget?
Well, I think that people have the right to all sorts of reactions, frankly, because in the ideal world of the president, it would all be enacted as is. But the reality of Washington may be a comfort to some of your listeners and may be a source of frustration to others. It's been a routine in Washington for decades that the president's budget proposal is dead on arrival. And this one has been arguably dead before arrival, if we look at the skinny budget reaction a couple of months ago. So, again, I don't know if that's comforting to everybody, because some of the reasons the president was elected to was to break through some of the gridlock and certainly take advantage of the fact that the president's party is holding both chambers of Congress as a majority. But it is very unlikely to stand as it is. That's a fact. And that has been widely reported throughout so-called left and right-wing media all day.
How does this budget compare with the ideals that candidate Donald Trump championed in his bid for the presidency?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's quite complicated, because candidate Donald Trump was not a traditional Republican. And a populist is someone who thinks that people at the bottom need a space in the government and the decision table, and that government needs to support people at the bottom and even needs to proactively intervene in the capitalist economy. So candidate Trump, remember transitioning in the inauguration week, he tried to intervene with job loss at Carrier in Indiana. And that's the type of ideological division that the Republican Party is having right now. Do we let markets play out, and that might include job losses and technological-based dislocation? trade, free trade, which is criticized in the budget, but is nevertheless crucial to low costs of many merchandise items that people buy every day, such as clothes. Do we want to change that? So the truth is, it's a very difficult question. Traditional Republicanism wants small conservative government with fewer regulations and fewer entitlements, both of the traditional insurance entitlements as well as means-tested programs, what we call welfare or food stamps. And the truth is, this budget is much more traditional Republican than candidate Trump has campaigned on. And more specifically, a few media sources have reported today, and I've double-checked this myself, that 7 out of the 10 states that voted for President Trump who have the largest to lose from food stamps. So again, of the top 10 states that per capita have food stamps up to 20%, in the case of Louisiana, 20% of the population, 1 in 5 people in Louisiana, accept some kind of SNAP or food stamp benefit. And so those types of decreases are a little puzzling, considering the electoral mandate.
We're talking right now with Jasmine Ferrier. She is a political science professor at the University of Louisville, talking about the Trump administration 2018 budget package that has been delivered by the White House to Congress today. Jasmine, let's break down some of the budget highlights. You have mentioned cuts to the poor, cuts to safety net programs, Medicaid, food stamps, Meals on Wheels, student loans. Who do you see are the winners and the losers in this budget proposal?
Well, the winners seem to be older Americans, because the two biggest programs that contribute to federal deficits and debt are Social Security and Medicare. However, those programs are arguably defensible because they are self-supported in part by payroll taxes. In other words, the philosophy here that Mick Mulvaney, the budget director, outlined is that taxpayers will receive more benefits back, whereas people who are not contributing to the federal treasury will have a harder time in this budget. So any program that requires being poor to qualify will be treated differently than programs where you have to put in some contribution, even if it's not the full contribution. And that's how Social Security and Medicare work.
And what about increase in military spending and border security? Does this budget include funding for President Trump's border wall with Mexico, which he promised in his campaign?
Yes, I think it's a smaller number. I'm looking at the president's budget document, which is easily accessible on whitehouse.gov, or you could Google OMB, which is the President's Office of Management and Budget, and you can find this 62-page document which outlines it. So, for example, I'm looking at it right now. It says the president's budget secures the borders by investing $2.6 billion in high-priority tactical infrastructure and border security technology, including funding to plan, design, and construct a physical wall. Now, $2.6 billion, of course, is not going to complete the wall, but we saw with the skinny budget that Congress sort of ignored that part.
Yeah. Do you expect Congress to do the same to this budget in terms of the wall?
It's possible. I think that with other infrastructure needs throughout the United States, including highways and subway systems as well as bridges, it might be a lower priority, but not necessarily ignored completely. As for military spending, the president has said several times that he wants to increase military spending, which is already capping about $600 billion a year and is, the next to Social Security and Medicare, the single largest discretionary part of the budget.
We've also heard about big tax cuts coming down the pipeline. No real details yet, though. What do we know so far about these huge tax cuts?
Well, I think that the argument is that, and the president has mentioned this before, that the corporate tax rate should be slashed from 35% to about 15%. But that's a somewhat separate legislative track, and that would probably need supermajorities in the House and Senate, especially in the Senate, to undo. As for the military, just going back to that, we do have to remember, I know this is complicated, but there was a budget sequestration agreement a couple of years ago, which was supposed to cap certain areas of federal spending. before the military spending increase can become permanent, Congress would also have to repeal the sequestration that was a holdover from the previous administration. In other words, prior spending deals are still in effect until the legislation changes it. So it's a two-step process for some of these spending caps to be busted.
So there is legislation on the line that would impact the calculations that are in this budget.
Absolutely. So one of the mysteries of presidential elections for average citizens is that a little bit changes when a new president takes office, but the truth is the new president and often the new Congress inherit the entire public policy universe of the previous administration and the previous Congress. So all programs and spending items are usually continued unless they have an expiration or a sunset. So a lot of the priorities as well as some of the budget restraints of the past are still in effect. That even is true for war, because the war against ISIS was inherited completely from President Obama. So when it comes to budgeting, that's a little bit separate because budgeting is supposed to be done on an annual basis. What we have seen, though, is that Congress's very complicated budget process, which we've barely touched on, has not really been fulfilled in recent years. So the government operates on what is called a continuing resolution, or a CR in Washington speak. And the continuing resolution is literally continuing the past, and this has just been passed recently to go all the way to September 30th. So right now we are living under past priorities, and this budget provides the president his real opportunity to change the conversation.
We're talking to political scientist Jasmine Ferrier from the University of Louisville now about President Trump's new budget.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How will the president's new budget affect you? Do you think the budget is a good thing for the future of the United States? And what do you like about the proposed budget? What would you change? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a minute. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our discussion now about the Trump budget with political science professor Jasmine Ferrier from the University of Louisville.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the president's proposed budget? Do you think this budget is likely to pass Congress? What would you like to see changed in this budget? What do you think is worth keeping? Call in now at 800-642-1234. You can also share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Jasmine, critics have said the president's promise of a 3% economic growth rate are just improbable. And we have a clip of Mulvaney, the president's budget director, on the calculations based on a 3% economic growth rate.
The 1.9% growth rates that the previous administration assumed towards the end of their administration and the 1.9% growth rates for the entire 10-year window that the CBO growth rates that the CBO assumes, the Congressional Budget Office assumes, are something we simply reject. That is a pessimistic look at what the potential for this country and for what this country's people is.
Well, you know, President Trump is a businessman first, and shouldn't he be confident with this economic growth potential that he's seeing? And why the disconnect between the two administrations on economic growth?
Well, I think the presidents of both parties would love to have robust economic growth, as would members of Congress in both parties. Nobody is against robust economic growth. And maybe the Federal Reserve would be the only institution in town that would be a little careful about that. The truth is, economic growth does solve a lot of budgetary problems. As we saw in the 1990s, which seems like a long time ago, but we did have balanced budgets by the end of the decades, in part because of robust economic growth, which increases tax revenue. Of course, right now, robust growth would not necessarily have to reach 3% to satisfy the average economist. The economic growth rate has been between, I think, 0.7 and 1.8%. So, yes, I think economists of both sides do not think 3% is likely. However, note the phrasing of the optimism. I think that it's normal for a politician to want to say that these priorities are going to stimulate growth to make up for the lost revenue of lower taxes. And this has been a budget philosophy that goes back to Ronald Reagan. And the argument is that the more money that you put in the pockets of investors and people who have more job-making possibilities, ideally, not always in reality, but ideally they would reinvest that into the economy through expansion and new workers.
And that's where the economic engine would really kick in.
Yes. So, of course, on the liberal side, the demand management side of the economy would be that economic growth is putting money in people's pockets. Even at the lowest ends of the economy, people need to eat, people need to shop, and consumer spending is actually the economic engine of the United States, and it has been for a long time. So the more money you put in people's pockets at any level, the more they will probably spend. It's a little bit more controversial to say that people at the top will pocket all the extra tax revenue and hire and train new workers.
Let's take a call now, Jeremy in Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm okay with the budget. I don't like all the cuts that are going on, but that's just, the pains that we're going to have to go through. We are a debtor's nation right now, and that's unsustainable. We borrow more money than we produce as a nation to pay for our bills, and we have to start throttling back on subsidies and things of that nature, or we're just going to go bankrupt. You can only keep drinking the Kool-Aid for so long until we're going to hit a wall. Our GDP is just stagnant. Our economy is stagnant growth. It's not robust as it once was. So we have to create budgets in accordance to what we actually can produce as a nation, capital-wise.
And Jasmine, how do you feel about that, what Jeremy has to say about, let this nation finally get out of debt?
Well, it's a very complicated question. Public opinion has been very divided on this. It depends how you ask the question. I think that nobody is pro a $20 trillion debt, and that's a 16 zeros. It's very hard for us to imagine. However, sometimes we like the policies that contribute to that debt. So if I ask the caller, what should we do about it? Should we raise taxes? Should we slash the military? Which really, it's a question of taxing or spending in a different way. And when we had an opportunity to pay down the debt, we didn't take that route as a country. So let's go back a little bit to the 2000 election. It sounds like a fairy tale, but it really happened that Governor Bush and Vice President Gore were debating what to do with the surplus. And Gore said he wanted to put it in a lockbox, and people made fun of that. And Governor Bush said, well, if you pay too much at the store and you have a little extra, they don't get to keep the change. You get the change. So what happened after that election when Governor Bush became President Bush, a lot of the budget rules that had helped to create the surplus condition were eliminated. So the budget was free, and especially after 9/11, when there was a whole new question of what to do and what our special priorities should be. And then, of course, the war in Iraq started that was not paid for by increases in taxes. We've had new entitlement programs under President Bush, including an expansion of Medicare drug benefits. We had a recession, and of course, recessions are very expensive when you have means-tested programs and more people qualify for them. And the list goes on and on.
And Jasmine, I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much for being with us. That was Jasmine Farrier, professor of political science at the University of Louisville. She joined us to take a look at the president's 2018 budget, which he just sent to Congress today.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Many of us have an affinity for certain trees. For Robert Root, it's an oak that's welcomed him to a section of the Ice Age Trail near his home.
Only after the oak had fallen did I realize how much it had cheered me whenever I saw it. It stood at the start of a secluded segment of the Ice Age Trail near Heartland. Barely into the forest, hikers had to dance around this huge bur oak, its limbs thrown wide as if in welcome. Another oak was in shadows just beyond it, and deeper in the woods, others were camouflaged by undergrowth and younger trees. But that first oak rooted itself in my memory. When my wife and I became stewards of that trail section, I looked forward to seeing that welcome oak. It stood apart from the thick forest that surrounded it, as if announcing that we were stepping into a special place, that we were stepping out of the preoccupations of a bustling world into a serene setting where, like the trees themselves, we had to think only about simply being. That tree activated an unsuspected affinity with bur oaks, and I enjoyed finding them all around Wisconsin. Bur oaks are solid, tall, expansive. Their limbs stretch out in every direction. They anchor open spaces where they easily survive grass fires sweeping across their encircling savannas. Once settlement impeded those fires, forest growth began to hem them in. They were most conspicuous on an open savanna, but harder to notice in forests along the Ice Age Trail. Whenever I spotted one nearly hidden in the woods, it would stop me in my tracks. The welcome oak, it turns out, for all its breadth and height, had long been hollow. Still, the wind that convinced it to keel over must have been powerful. It wasn't uprooted, flattened on the ground, but bent at its ankles, as if it had tripped while walking in the woods. It lay across the trail, its long limbs outstretched like something trying to catch itself as it fell. The upper branches now sprawled close to the ground, held up partly by lower trees and bushes. If you didn't know the trail once led around it, you might find it hard to locate the trailhead when you entered the forest. Ice Age Trail volunteers sawed off some limbs and rerouted the trail. The welcome oak maintained its plank position, refusing to fully hit the ground. The last time I saw it, it had rolled across the rerouted trail, but it was still high enough for me to scooch under. The crew will need to come back, trim it more, but let it take its own good time to collapse entirely. It will take a while. When I visit it now, though fallen, I pause to consider its longevity. I remember that before this forest, and before the agriculture and industry and affluent suburb around it, this oak rose nearly alone in open space.
That was Wisconsin Life from Wisconsin Public Radio and executive producer Erica Janik. First, a veteran science teacher and researcher is worried that the instruction in science classrooms across the U.S. and Canada doesn't adequately prepare students for real-world scientific careers. The problem, he says, isn't the teachers, but it's the curriculum they're obligated to teach, one that's overly broad and covers more topics with less depth.
Chris McGowan took early retirement as dinosaur curator at Canada's Royal Ontario Museum to study how science is taught in high schools and colleges. His new book is called Saving Science Class, Why We Need Hands-on Science to Engage Kids, Inspire Curiosity, and Improve Education. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's lay out your argument. What's wrong with science education today? Where has it gone astray?
Well, let me read you a little bit that was written in recent New York Times. It said, nearly 90% of high school graduates say they're not interested in a career or a college major involving science. One of the biggest reasons for the lack of interest is that students have been turned off. Why have they been turned off? It's because educationalists, specialists in educational theory, who have little understanding of science themselves, have taken control of science teaching in our schools. It's not the poor teacher's fault. It's what they're instructed to teach and how to teach it.
So what is
That's
wrong
the
with
problem?
Yeah, what is wrong with the curriculum?
Well, let's first of all look at the Next Generation Science Standards, the new benchmark for US schools. The Next Generation Science Standards was founded upon a framework for K-12 science education. This was an almost 400-page document, and it is said to be based on a rich and growing body of research on teaching and learning in science. So you could expect an enormous amount of influence from educationalists. And this is supported by the fact that, remarkably, of the 432 cited references in this great tome, only 8 pertain to science. All the rest relate to education, psychology, sociology, cognition, philosophy, and all the rest. And this is obvious from the so many things in that great document. EduSpeak, most of it I can't understand. It's written in the usual language that confound teachers, parents, when they go to teacher meetings at school and listen to some of the things. And they keep theorising and emphasising on hypotheses. There's all the attention paid to abstract models. Here's a nice quote. Curricula will need to stress the role of models explicitly and provide students with modelling tools like Modelit, NetLogo, spreadsheet models. Why not get on and do real experiments? Why all this twaddle and this concentration on philosophizing over science? Just for the hell of it, I counted up how many times the word experiment appears in the Next Generation Science Standards document. 14 times in the entire 102 pages. The word model, in contrast, appears so many times, I stopped counting when I reached 94 on page 35.
So you're a big supporter of hands-on teaching, but we know students spend many hours in labs, especially at the college level. Isn't this hands-on science going on in their labs?
I don't think so. But my brightest grandson, dead interested in science, and this is typical of Canada, same as it is in the US. I said to him up at a cottage in the summer, "So what was science like this year?" And he said, "Boring." I said, "Well, what did you do?" He said, "We did one experiment in the entire year. We weighed a glass of water, added salt and reweighed it." Jeez, you know. And one of the things that gets me is in the framework document and the Next Generation Science Standards, there's so much absolute nonsense. Listen to this. It's a quote from the framework. "An example of use of energy should include internal motion, e.g. heartbeat, external motion, self-propulsion, breathing, or maintenance of body temperature." Now, what twaddle is this? No biologist would make such a ridiculous statement. You'll have to read the book for other examples of glaring scientific ignorance displayed in the framework document.
We're talking right now with author Chris McGowan. His new book is Saving Science Class, Why We Need Hands-on Science to Engage Kids, Inspire Curiosity, and Improve Education. Chris, it seems schools today are very strapped for cash everywhere, and getting the materials to do these experiments could be a roadblock to doing a hands-on experiment for every student in the class. But at one point in your book, you're telling teachers to be more resourceful. You encourage teachers to find a dead bird and use the bird's wing for the lesson in flight. Will teachers really do that, scavenge for science material?
Why not? I did. I taught at school in the early days when I was working for my PhD, and we did a lot of scratching around for things. Give you an example. I was doing a hands-on science thing for some science teachers, biggest collection of science teachers in Canada, actually. And I showed them a simple setup using an empty milk carton filled with some sand, using this as a test bed to test the drag on three plasticine models that you can make and attach to drinking straws with a pin, a disc, a sphere, and a streamline, and you get real, meaningful results. You can repeat Pasteur's classic experiment showing that bacteria exist in the air using nothing more complicated than a pair of empty wine bottles and a microwave. Having written the book, Make Your Own Dinosaurs Out of Chicken Bones, I don't think there are many things I couldn't devise an experiment for teaching kids and engaging kids and getting kids to think about science. When I taught science all those years ago, God, over half a century ago, the kids were doing what was described as Nuffield science. They spent all their time experimenting. And at first I thought, I can't get my head around this. Wouldn't it be better if I stood in front of them and told them about Pasteur and his experiments? But I saw what these kids were doing by their own experience. They were learning, they were enthused, and they were understanding. And I learned from that lesson of teaching at high school for 4 years, a valuable lesson which lasted me throughout my teaching career at university. If youngsters are properly directed and enthused, they will learn. And the only way to learn science is by practical hands-on experience. It's rubbish to go onto the internet and look at models and look at all these schemes and things. Do the experiments. It's pretty easy stuff.
Let's unpack for a moment this Nuffield Science Teaching Project. You had your schooling in the United Kingdom, and what is this Nuffield Science Teaching Project? Why is it promising, and could it be adopted in the U.S.?
I can't see why not. What happened is people, I suppose soon after the war, I grew up during the tail end of the war, we were used to improvising. We were always building things and out of odds and ends. There weren't many toys in the shop. And kids got engaged. And the teachers, a number of teachers got together and they thought, how can we make science more interesting and more applicable for kids? And somebody had the idea, a number of people had the idea, we should be doing more experimentation. And the school I taught at in London was one of the schools that was used in the beginnings of teaching of, in this case, Nuffield Biology, because I was a biology teacher. And it's absolutely remarkable what was achieved by interacting with scientists. Something that happened in the States, and I joined in on this, where scientists were engaging in going into school classrooms. I couldn't travel to go into school classrooms, but I interacted with teachers by internet and on the phone. And by interacting with real scientists, and I suggest retired scientists would be the target audience, because people are too busy they're trying to publish and get in ahead of the game to spend time going into schools. But I think teachers could certainly engage retired scientists, and I think something could be done to work on getting together something where kids can be doing practical, real science in the classroom. I'm a real scientist, and it really bugs me when I read all this twaddle that's talked about, and all the some of the requirements for the next generation science standards are totally ridiculous. It's crazy to think of some kids doing the things that are outlined in here. That kids give you some examples. Students in grade one, for example, are expected to answer questions like, what objects are in the sky and how do they seem to move? By grade two, students are able to do far more, expected to do far more complicated things. Some of these things I have a difficulty understanding. Students are able to use information and models to identify and represent the shapes and kinds of land and bodies of water in an area where water is found on Earth. What on earth does that mean?
Chris McGowan is with us right now to discuss what he sees as a disconnect in science education, a lack of hands-on science and a curriculum that covers too many areas. His new book is called Saving Science Class, Why We Need Hands-on Science to Engage Kids, Inspire Curiosity, and Improve Education.
We invite you to think back to your science classes. What stuck out to you? What worked and what didn't? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your science teachers make you want to learn more with what they put in front of you to do? Did it put you on that path to pursue a career in science, or did it not? If you're a science teacher, what do you see as your biggest challenges? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post your thoughts on science education over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation with Chris McGowan. He's a retired dinosaur curator for Canada's Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. His new book is called Saving Science Class. It makes the case that science education today lacks hands-on learning opportunities and is overly broad.
And you can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. What did you think of how science was taught to you, and how did it influence your career path? What questions do you have for Chris in his approach to science education? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Chris, you make the argument that the science education curriculum is too broad, that it's too one-size-fits-all, and specifically engineering and technology should be excluded because so you can go more in-depth to some of the basic science. Where do you stand on that?
Well, the framework document itself points out that the often used quote about curricula in the United States being a mile wide and an inch deep, and it doesn't help if you cram in all these other things. When I was teaching biology, I had a full-time job teaching biology. I couldn't have taught astronomy and geology and all the other things, even if I'd have been equipped to. It's better to do the basics, the physics, chemistry, and biology, and do it properly and form a firm foundation for the future. I use things that I learned when I was a kid in high school. I still draw upon these things here in my dotage, for gosh sake, because, you know, we were taught science the proper way. We learned by understanding. You know, the annoying thing is it's people that got no understanding of science themselves that come up with all this twaddle that you see in the next generation science standards. Imagine kids aged 7 to 13 being able to answer questions like, what is Earth's place in the universe? I mean, or how does water influence weather, circulate in the oceans and shape the Earth's surface? I mean, I read in one of the papers that was cited in the framework document that scientists hold competitions for the models that they make. I mean, what a lot of old rubbish. This is not real science. This is make-believe science, and there's no place for it in the school classroom.
Well, let's jump in here and get a call now with Larry from Milwaukee. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I think what the gentleman is talking about is right in line with the philosopher Alfred North Whitehead. He was a mathematician, but he wrote in an essay called The Rhythm of Education that kids go through several stages in any subject area. And the first stage is romance, and the second stage is precision. And what teachers tend to do and what schools tend to do is to force kids into the stage of precision before allowing them the romance of playing around with the subject. And when the kids are forced to take part in science fairs, that's putting them into precision, too.
Chris?
Yeah. There's something in the Next Generation Science Standards. Use a model to illustrate how photosynthesis transforms light energy into stored chemical energy. Why would you make a model, for goodness sake? You just get it. I went to the local supermarket and grabbed a handful of old spinach that had been knocking around, stuffed it in a mason jar, filled it up with water, and I could collect oxygen. I could see how the plants were using up oxygen at night times in darkness and generating carbon dioxide because you put a match in there and the match is extinguished. I mean, it's not hard stuff to do. It's not rocket science. It's basic hands-on science. But these silly people, these educationists that know absolutely nothing about science themselves for the most part, they go into all this twaddle about models and testing and all this rubbish. It really makes me very, very cross.
And Larry, thank you so much for your call. Now let's go to Mark in Two Rivers. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to add?
Well, I couldn't agree with your host more. He's a man after my heart. And Yeah, he uses the word twaddle. I think I would use another name. But I ran into this exact same problem with when my kids were going through high school and grade school, and I would constantly have to undo what they were taught and reteach them to make sure that they understood it correct. I was constantly running into problems with what I refer to as touchy-feely assignments that really added nothing to the science that they were learning, but it sure looks good on paper. And, well, that's what I have to say. And he talked about the four foundations of chemistry, physics, and biology. I would like to add one to that. I also think at a very young age, children should be taught to computer science and taught to code.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for that. And Chris, you have done presentations in front of so many audiences to show your approach to hands-on science. What have critics told you about your approach to science education?
Critics to my approach? I haven't come across any. When I did this presentation to the Science Teachers Association of Canada, I had a number of teachers coming up to me afterwards and saying, "You're right, it's rubbish, we're stuck with it." There was one woman that sticks in my mind, and she said, "When I close my classroom door, I teach science the way it's meant to be taught." Then she said, "But I have to examine them according to this curricular nonsense." And this really, really does upset me. And it upsets me to think that the kids that I taught back in the 60s had a better understanding of science than kids do today. And this is not a good place to be.
So why is the teaching of science such a contentious issue in the education community?
It's because educationalists have taken control. We had a saying in England when I was a teacher, if you can't do it, inspect it. If you can't do it, teach it. I mean, if you can't get a job in your field, then teach it. And if you can't teach it, if you're a no good teacher, inspect it, meaning get into the administration of education. And this is what's happening. And these people, most of them work in departments of education, and that the reason it reminds me of the wars I had with creationists during the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But you could pull their arguments apart because they were paper thin. But these people, they don't get attacked because nobody can understand what on earth they're saying. If you've ever gone into some of this literature that they publish, you can't understand a word of it. It's only people in the biz that understand it. And they just don't make sense.
We have time for another quick call. Lydia in Duluth. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. When you talk about like education today and the hands-on, I'm a millennial, and so I graduated high school within the last couple of years, and I did have a lot of hands-on stuff in chemistry. It was very hands-on. There wasn't a lot of testing. Testing was how you executed the experiment, and I took anatomy, physiology in high school, and we dissected cats, and so there wasn't a lot of testing involved. It really was hands-on, and that made it more engaging, and we wanted to learn, and we wanted to know more because we weren't just sitting and reading about it. We were doing it.
Lydia, may I ask, was it in a public education setting?
Yes.
Chris, there are glimmers of hope out there for you, I think.
Yes, you were very lucky to go to such a school, but most kids are stuck, and poor teachers too, with all this stuff that they're... And these educationalists, they make a cottage industry for themselves. One of the guys that was one of the lead writers for the framework document, he's got his consulting company, and he's been consulting for
And Chris, I'm going to have to stop you short there. We are out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
That was Chris McGowan. His new book is Saving Science Class, Why We Need Hands-on Science to Engage Kids, Inspire Curiosity, and Improve Education. He's Curator Emeritus at Canada's Royal Ontario Museum. And we can continue this conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page, where you can share your thoughts on your science education. when you think of pastel colors and rainbows and My Little Pony, surely your mind goes to food. The unicorn food trend is turning everything pink and purpley, from Starbucks drinks to makeup.
Right, and there's also unicorn toast. We remember, of course, the unicorn frappuccino. There's unicorn noodles.
Yep.
There's unicorn tears lipstick and unicorn hair color, too. It just keeps spreading.
Supposedly, a lot of the color comes from healthy sources like blue-green algae, beets, and hibiscus, even though it looks like it's slightly radioactive.
And analysts say the trend is the result of nostalgia for the past and also, I guess, a cultural need for stuff that's happy and bright. I mean, so I guess that the antidote to all the stuff that's scary and dark in the world is really brightly colored food and hair and makeup.
So when you hit a low, you're supposed to eat and think unicorns?
Right. You should douse yourself in rainbows is what I'm hearing, Kate.
Nice. I don't know if I'm going to go the hair color route, though.
It is kind of neat. You know, I think you'd have to be pretty young to pull it off. I think that ship has sailed for me, but, you know, it's kind of fun to look at.
Oh.
Well, you're listening to Central Time. If you've tried out the unicorn trend, let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network.